there is a growing concern for health and safety of EMS workers. Recent research from MSARN has highlighted sleep quality and fatigue among EMS workers all across the United States. This data shows that a large proportion of workers suffer from sleep quality and fatigue. Many in EMS want to know more about the problem and risk to providers and patients. Today, we talk with an expert in the legal matters of fatigue. This month, we had the opportunity to speak with Clark Lee, a lawyer and a senior law and policy analyst at the University of Maryland's Center for Health and Homeland Security. Mr. Lee's area of expertise focuses on sleep, laws, and public policies affecting emergency responders. First, though, we needed to start this podcast off with a disclaimer for Mr. Lee.
Well, first off, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure. I do need to do the, good lawyer disclaimer thing and say that everything I'm about to say should not be construed as formal legal advice. All the opinions expressed are my own and are not those of any of the organizations that I'm affiliated with, including University of Maryland, Baltimore, and the Center for Health and Homeland Security. And the contents of this interview should only be taken for educational purposes. Obviously, seek your own legal counsel for formal legal advice.
Secondly, we started our interview by asking Mr. Lee about the legal concerns with fatigue in a high-risk industry such as EMS.
You can almost divide the issues into two categories. First are employment law sort of concerns, and then the other is liability, especially tort liability concerns. With regard to employment, first off, there are some jurisdictions where there may be hours of service regulations in place that need to be abided by. There are also some jurisdictions where the occupational health and safety laws are such that it could be argued that employers are required by law to establish a environment that minimizes the detrimental effects of long work hours. Certainly over in Europe, that has emerged as a hot issue, if you will. Here in the United States, however, when it comes to issues of occupational safety and health, of course, when we talk about OSHA, as far as I know, OSHA has not come up with any standards when it comes to particular work hours or fatigue mitigation standards.
Mr. Lee was able to provide us with two legal cases where fatigue was a contributing factor and discuss the liability of all parties involved.
I'm aware of two cases, and this doesn't come from EMS or health services per se, but I do think it is somewhat illustrative of general principles or potential issues that may arise in healthcare or EMS sort of settings. First came out of West Virginia back in 1983, and it involved a 19-year-old railroad laborer who fell asleep while driving home after being required to work for about 27 hours without rest, resulting in a non-fatal crash with another vehicle. Summary of the facts were that this individual reported to work at 7 a.m. at an office about 50 miles from where he lived. 3 hours later, he was deployed to a derailment site about halfway between his office site and his work site. And at about 10 p.m. that evening, he had informed the foreman at this derailment site that he was tired and wanted to go home. The individual was told that he could not go home, but that he could talk to sort of the roadmaster who was in charge of the site. The individual laborer did not do so and continued working. Finally, at about 9 a.m. the following morning, he did speak to the roadmaster, and he was told that he could, in fact, go home. He actually asked for a ride from the railroad company that employed him to take him back to his office so that he could get into his car and drive back home. It was observed that during this ride back to the office, he had actually fallen asleep with a lit cigarette in his hand. And then, so he gets taken back to his office, and then he begins the 50-mile drive back home. Somewhere between the derailment site and his house, he got into a car crash causing injuries to another person.
So the victims in this other car sued the railroad
worker and the railroad company employing him for the damages resulting from this car crash. The victims, or the plaintiffs, who are now the plaintiffs, actually settled with the railroad worker, but the tort claims against the railroad company went to trial. These claims alleged that the railroad company had illegally, willfully, wantonly, negligently, and with a conscious disregard for the rights and safety of others, ordered, forced, and required its employee to work for 32 hours straight without rest, and then to leave the place of employment without providing either rest or transportation home when it knew or should have known that its employee constituted a menace to the health and safety of the public. So all that was actually taken, was quoted from the plaintiff's complaint. And the plaintiffs further argued that as a result of these actions were, quote, the proximate cause of the automobile accident in which they were injured. So this case against the railroad company went to trial. The plaintiffs presented their evidence, and at the end of their case, the railroad company asked the court essentially to rule in its favor as a matter of law. That is, they were asking the court to take the case out of the jury's hand because the evidence that had been presented was of such a nature that no reasonable jury could come to any sort of other conclusion, that there was only one conclusion that could be drawn and that there was really no question for them to consider. In essence, the railroad company argued that the plaintiffs had failed to make a factual showing to demonstrate that a duty of care existed on the part of the railroad company towards these car crash victims of the plaintiffs, or to demonstrate that the conduct of the railroad company was the proximate cause of the accident. Trial court wound up accepting this argument and granted the motion in favor of the railroad company. So, of course, the plaintiffs appealed this decision to the West Virginia State Supreme Court, which subsequently reversed the trial court's decision. In summary, the West Virginia Supreme Court found that the evidence that the plaintiffs had produced at trial presented a question for the jury as to whether the railroad company's conduct in requiring its employee to work 27 hours and then to set the employee loose on the highway in an obviously exhausted condition created a foreseeable risk of harm to others, which the employer, the railroad company, had a duty to guard against. A second case came a few years later in Oregon. I believe it was in the late 80s. And what happened was an 18-year-old employee of a fast food restaurant fell asleep while driving home after working three shifts in a 24-hour period and five nights during the preceding week. This particular employee wound up getting into a fatal car crash in which he was killed. The summary of this case was that the 18-year-old employee, who was a high school student at the time, volunteered to work a special cleanup shift that lasted from midnight to 5 a.m. at this particular fast food restaurant. During the week before this cleanup project, he worked five nights. On one of those nights, he worked past midnight. Another night, he worked until about 11:30 p.m. Another night, he worked until 11 p.m., and on two nights, he worked until about 9 p.m. During the shift, the worker told his manager that he was tired and asked to be excused from his next regularly scheduled shift schedule so that he could rest. Manager agreed, and it was on the 20-mile drive home from this last shift that he got into the car accident that caused his death. So the plaintiffs actually, as was the case in the West Virginia case with the railroad workers, the accident victims actually settled their claims against the surviving representatives of the drowsy employee, who in this case was deceased. But the plaintiffs also sued the employer, which in this case was a fast food restaurant, and alleged that the restaurant was, quote, negligent in requiring the employee to work too many hours without adequate rest, and in permitting the employee to drive a car when the defendant should have known that he, the employer, could not drive safely. This complaint was actually later slightly amended to allege that, quote, the defendant restaurant was negligent in working its employee more hours than was reasonable under the circumstances when defendant knew or in the exercise of reasonable care should have known that the employee would operate a motor vehicle and be a hazard to himself and to others. So at several stages during the trial, the defendant restaurant attempt to have the case dismissed or moved to have a ruling in its favor using arguments similar to what the railroad company in the West Virginia case had made. However, in the case of this Oregon case, the trial court allowed the case to proceed both to trial and to a jury verdict, which ultimately came out in favor of the plaintiff's accident victims. So in this case, the defendant restaurant appealed this jury verdict to a higher appeals court, and an intermediate appeals court in Oregon upheld the jury verdict. In essence, the appellate court concluded that the plaintiffs had presented enough evidence at trial that was to support that could support a finding that the defendant restaurant knew or should have known that its employee was a hazard to himself and others when he drove home from his workplace after working, the strenuous schedule and numerous hours.
The two cases I just described, you may have noticed, they were all related to accidents that happened while the employee had already, ended their shift and was actually driving back home. And, there are always arguments about whether this fall in the scope of their duties and whether the employer should be held liable. But as you say, in the case of EMS providers, because driving is within the scope of their duties, in my opinion, I would think that EMS providers are potentially, subjecting themselves to significant liability by, allowing highly fatigued workers to continue providing services in the field.
Finally, we know fatigue is a complex issue, and many EMS managers would like to know the ultimate shift length based on available data. While unfortunately there is no exact shift length that is best in light of the current data, Mr. Lee was able to provide some risk mitigation strategies for EMS agencies, not only those who are concerned with long shift lengths.
So this is certainly a really tough question that emergency responders and managers of all stripes have to grapple with. Certainly an issue that I and my colleagues grapple with in working with emergency planners and managers. That is, how do you schedule shifts for these responders during an emergency that are safe and do not exacerbate impacts of fatigue? I personally do not believe I necessarily have the expertise to address that question directly. That said, however, issues of fatigue and fatigue management certainly can be viewed as another type of hazard risk that needs to be managed in a work context. As with other types of risks, one of the first steps is to assess what the risks are and to identify what the risk factors are. There's no one-size-fits-all solution to it, but by knowing where things stand for a particular organization, I believe that certainly is a useful first step from which natural fatigue risk management plan can be developed, which includes actual controls to mitigate the risk, of which shift patterns and schedules is certainly one element. And I know that in recent years, the National Response Team, which I believe is a conglomerate of different federal agencies, has come out with a guidance document on managing worker fatigue during disaster operations. In this particular document, which is available on the web, there is a fatigue risk management tool that they've created for organizations to take and use to sort of assess what the fatigue risks are within their organization and among their workers. This being about disaster response operations, it certainly, I believe, resonates with EMS operations and the work that you all do, and it might be a useful tool to take a look at and perhaps try using as a first step to figuring out, what actually needs to be done.
Stay tuned to MSARN for more on this topic. Email us to get involved as a participating EMS agency and receive detailed reports that allow you to benchmark your agency's fatigue or safety culture data to base rate data and other agencies. To learn more about MSARN or to leave feedback on our podcast, log on to podcast.msarn.org. For MSARN, my name is Charlie Warner, and I'm just an ambulance driver. Thank you, and good day.